Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. How are you doing, Beth Ann?
Good morning. Doing all right, thank you. How about you?
Not too bad. We keep hearing the phrase doubling down with regard to the president's activities, and his latest double down is on immigration.
And we've been talking about that since the first executive order in January. Now we have another one set to go into effect next week.
Right.
And we're going to talk about that this morning with a, through a different bit of lens, rather. How art reflects politics, you know, is nothing new. But what may be new is how art will respond this time around in an era of changing relationships with immigrants and refugees. Of course, the latest executive order from President Trump on immigration will go in effect on March 16. This week, MIT writing professor and Pulitzer Prize-winning author Junot Diaz is in Honolulu to speak at a series of events about the nexus of art and immigration. First, he's here to talk with us this morning. Welcome to the program, and thank you for making some time in your schedule.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
When we talk about how art and activism go hand in hand, we can point to various movements looking back over our shoulder. But how do you see it happening this time around in such a very different political climate for example, your students?
Well, that's the best part. We don't have any idea yet how it's going to play out. What strikes me as fascinating is how generative the response has been to the Trump administration, how these enormous reservoirs of creativity have begun to just explode. It's been rather remarkable to see. And how it's going to all play out, no idea. But that art is forming the backbone of resistance and opening up spaces for people to gather. And that's, I think, patent.
That kind of passion is sometimes tough to sustain, particularly when you're talking about movements forming and how they take a period of time to become actual bona fide movements. In the way you are talking about now, the fact that we don't know so much of what we don't know, what are you hearing back from your students that might give us at least an indication?
Well, I mean, it's not just my students. I'm a person who's involved in community work outside of the university. Ultimately, this idea that one can sustain anything is just a fantasy, a great fantasy that people have. We're human beings. We're easily distracted. We have life cycles. We're more about disruption than we are about continuity in many ways. And what matters most, I think, that I'm hearing is that we're seeing a whole entire generation, both young and old, acquiring a new vocabulary around resistance, acquiring a new idiom around our ideals as people and as communities. Folks who had never before kind of raised questions about, well, what are our values? What's worth fighting for? Are beginning to entertain those questions and to grapple with them. And that's not insignificant. And that has a longitudinal effect even beyond the moments where these movements go quiescent.
For those movements and for the fact that we know that they will sometimes simply just peter out, that ethos that has moved generationally from, say, some of our parents in the Vietnam era to some of us who came along a little later sometimes has gone fallow, too. And we've heard from many who are in the generation of 60s activists that, you know, what's wrong with the rest of you? And they're looking to the generation even, you know, younger than millennials to keep it moving or to keep it going. And I sometimes feel for them in the fact that they think that somehow a lot of what they did and a lot of their work has gone unnoticed by at least the generation that came immediately after. Do you see any of those parallels or any of those types of those patterns as you talk to communities throughout the country?
Well, look, we belong to a country where public education has been systematically gutted. We belong to a country where our imaginary around our own histories, especially histories of resistance and struggle, the histories that come out of the 60s globally, have been completely erased and demonized. Given all of these assaults, given all of these erasures, the fact that a lot of these questions are still on the table, that some folks have access to this information is, I think, something that we should celebrate. In a different world, I promise you that there's a different reality out there where this same system has played out and we haven't done as well and maintaining the memories from the 60s and 70s global struggles as we have here, we sometimes forget that we're doing the best we can. Now, for me, I have great hope that these things are not as linear, one-to-one, as people like to pretend they are. That's not the way history works. History is more like quantum physics. It has spooky effects. We don't know the influence and the impact we've made, even when things seem that we've made no impact and we've been entirely forgotten. A generation that comes down the line rediscovers and reinvigorates and recuperates efforts that folks have thought were meaningless. And that's something that we have to remember, is that this is not an easy struggle, that there are going to be tremendous setbacks, that there's all the power and all the money directed at making us forget who we are, and yet we continue to push on, and that's not a minor thing.
That also seems to say that you need to take the long view.
Or how about just simply that often even the narratives of how we evaluate how well we've done are influenced by people who want us to fail. I think a lot of this history of who we are and what we've done and the sort of cynicism and the defeatism feeds right into the narratives of the hegemony, the narratives that tell us, see, these movements are stupid, these movements are irrelevant, these movements are frivolous. And it's easy to pick up that logic, to pick up that flow. Certainly a long view, but also a sense of possibility and hope, the very thing that drove and created these spaces and created these movements, I think has to be maintained even in the darkest of times.
For a lot of people, they're seeing dark times right now, and trying to access that hope is a little difficult. There are many who have come through this studio who have said words like, I'm so depressed, I'm so upset, I don't know what to do. And yet they're in positions where they can do something, and the response seems to be, well, what are you going to do? What would you suggest they do?
I always say it's the same thing. It always looks dark till we help someone who's worse off than us. Any of my students would tell me, oh, I'm feeling depressed, I don't know if I can go on. I'm just like, let's go to the elderly home right down the street and spend an hour reading and talking to those folks. Because what we recall when we help people who are less better off than us is not how bad we have it. What we recall is our tremendous agency vis-a-vis other people. And that, I think, is salutary.
It's a way of being able to reaccess our own humanity.
And to stop narrativizing this from the point of view that we're disenfranchised and that we have no agency. Everybody has agency. Everyone. And how we use our agency determines whether this is going to be a long, dark age or a very short one, whether the dawn will come bright or it won't come at all.
You're here to speak about a number of things, but the title of one of your talks is I Will Build a Great Wall, Notes on Borders, Immigrants, and the Future in the Age of Trump. If you had to leave us with a few bits from that that you would like us to think about, what would they be?
I think here in Hawaii, all of these factors are playing out very clearly. It doesn't need me to spell them out too much. But ultimately, we can no more cruelly legislate against immigration in such an irresponsible way as we could legislate against climate change. Immigration is a reality. We have to begin to create cultures that allow us to be hospitable, allow us to respond to the new communities around us in ways that maintain our humanity. We are going to need these skills. The future is going to be very challenging. We know this. Climate change is going to disrupt the planet. It's going to just throw millions of people out of their spaces, out of their islands. And we're going to have to figure out how we live in this world together. We created this problem. Just because we happen to be in higher ground doesn't mean it isn't our responsibility. It's all of our responsibility. And learning cultures of hospitality, of compassion, are going to be essential for our survival. You can build walls and you can legislate. And if you do that, we will all be destroyed. On the other hand, if we create cultures and climates of openness, of dealing with this issue in a humane way, we will survive.
On that hopeful note, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Junot Diaz was born in the Dominican Republic and raised in New Jersey. His first novel, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde, won the 2008 Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award. His 2015 work, This Is How You Lose Her, was a New York Times bestseller and National Book Award finalist. A professor of writing at MIT, Junot Diaz is in Honolulu for a series of events, including the lecture we just mentioned, I Will Build a Great Wall, Notes on Borders, Immigrants, and the Future in the Age of Trump. You can see our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation, for the full list of events.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Hawaii Theater Center, presenting songwriter and jazz vocalist Storm Large, 7 p.m. this Friday. Tickets at hawaiitheater.com.
Aloha! This is Lauren Ober, host of The Big Listen, NPR's broadcast about podcasts. We're thrilled when podcasts take on another life. And on March 11th, HPR will start airing a special radio series, which started as a podcast, from Honolulu Civil Beat. The five-week series is called Offshore, and it's storytelling about a Hawaii most tourists never see. Ooh! Offshore, starting March 11th, during The Big Listen Hour, Saturdays at 4 p.m.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, a Maori filmmaker explores the mystical traditions of her culture. But first, here's your backyard quiz.
Coming up in the program, we'll hear about a biofuel project on Maui that's growing sunflowers to use as a source of energy. Biofuel is a catch-all term for energy produced directly from living matter. Ethanol, which is produced from corn, is the most commonly used biofuel, but several other sources are growing in popularity around the world, one of them being sunflower oil. Sunflowers have been sprouting up in fields around North America, including the mountains of New England, the high plains of Colorado, and the shores of Western Canada. The harvested sunflower seeds are dried at room temperature, pressed into oil that can be burned for internal combustion. Although a large crop of sunflowers will be a new addition to Maui's fields, it's already a common, if often overlooked, sight in another of Hawaii's small agricultural towns. And for today's quiz, we want to know which town that is. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer.
Aloha, I'm Sonia Patel from Honolulu, Hawaii. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
What happens to the spirit when it leaves the body? Human societies around the world have their own versions of that story, primal myths at the heart of their culture. Maori artist Lisa Rehana has created a film that draws on her culture's version of mortality called Tai Waituki, House of Death. It was inspired by a historic collection piece at the Bishop Museum, the Tahitian chief mourner's costume, on display in the museum's Pacific Hall. We talked about Lisa's film with her yesterday.
A number of years ago, we discovered that my father had Alzheimer's. And so I suppose you get to a certain point in your life when you have to start considering these things, and mm-hmm. and that notion of the generations and those that come before you and those that come after. I mean, I think in New Zealand, black is considered, or for Maori culture anyway, black is considered a place where creativity and all life starts from. Even in our creation myths, it's almost like the Big Bang mm-hmm. theory is embodied in a way, if you choose to see it like that.
Things emerging from darkness
yes.
rather than light.
Yes. And so I don't see it. I mean, I see there's really positive aspects in that kind of the dark and moodiness. Mm-hmm. But also I was interested in the dark too, because I've come from a filmmaking background and I now work with video. And you're always looking at the light, and there was a trick. I mean, I was really playing with some cinematic tricks within the film itself, but also there was a way that Hollywood used to do what they call filming day for night.
Right.
So there's this kind of trickery that's in it, and
yeah.
and as a filmmaker, I really wanted to explore some technical aspects and play with that, mm-hmm. And use that as a device to create a storyline that looks at the movement of spirit as it departs the body and returns to the ether, mm-hmm. and create a sort of otherworldly space.
What's the story of your movie?
Tai Whutuki, House of Death. It's kind of, well, I got really interested, just picking up on that notion of dark and light. I got really interested when people were talking about near-death experiences, that they would move towards the light.
Yeah.
And for me, I started to think, well, actually, that's what happens when a baby is being born. They're coming out of the darkness
sure.
and out of the sort of amniotic fluid mm-hmm. and into the light. So although in some ways it's about death, it's very much about life as well. And I think that there's often dualities and there's balances and checks that happen in many, many places, and certainly that was something that I wanted to play with within this film.
In a number of cultures, Lisa, birth and death are seen as completion, you know, the completion of a circle.
Yes, correct. And I think I wanted to think about those things in relation to my father. In Maori culture, we use the word whakapapa. I'm sure there's a very similar word in the Hawaiian language, and that notion of the cycles, but the generations and that time, you know, it's important how time moves through. People say, oh, I wish I was younger, and I would never wish myself back anywhere. And I talk about it's great to get older because friendships become longer and much deeper, mm-hmm. and it can only happen with time in the mix. So it's a really positive thing. So what happens, I suppose, as a general sense of the narrative, we see a Maori warrior running through the bush, finding a place. He looks at his hand and there's blood on it. He touches his head and he sees, you know, he's obviously been injured, and he lies back to die. Mm-hmm. And then I bring in this figure who wears a mask, which is based on the Tuatara, which was the oldest living creature, lizard on Earth. It belongs to New Zealand. Mm-hmm. It's one lizard that has a third eye on the top of its head. So the third eye is always, again, thinking about that Buddha completion, those kind of ideas. Mm-hmm. And what he does is he ties a rope to the warrior. And the idea for me is that he's pulling his spirit, connecting that umbilical cord back through.
Right.
And he is accompanying him across this landscape and across the water, because I find many, many cultures all also have this idea that after death, there's a body of water that needs to be
yes,
crossed.
Yeah.
And
the river Styx.
Yeah, the river Styx. And where my tribe is from, in the far north of the North Island, there is a very important Pahutukawa tree, and the Pahutukawa tree is where the spirit climbs up and jumps across into the water and returns to Hawaiki. So I wanted to look at that, but also where the feminine principle sits in the midst of it all. And we have Hine Nui Te Pō, who's a mythological figure, and she is the woman or the great grandmother or the great goddess that welcomes you in as the spirit passes into the underworld. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to think about her as that very warm presence, that this kind of lizard-like figure accompanies you on that journey, and that there's a woman there to welcome you in at the end. So I wanted to have even though it's sort of set in this dark blue inky kind of space, I did want to feel like you're not alone and that the spirit goes back into this other place and it's not a lonely place. When a number of relations have passed away, often another person's been there at the same time at what we call a tangi, much like a wake. We spend 3 days with the bodies and tell stories. And oftentimes when I was overseas and an auntie passed away and a young person did at the same time, and my sister said to me, "Oh, isn't it great? They'll go off together. They won't be alone," and that move. So,
in a way, Lisa, for one thing, it sounds as if in Maori culture that darkness doesn't have the connotations it has in European culture, where it's almost inevitably associated with, you know, gloom, death, endings rather than beginnings.
Yes. Well, the duality is often in other cultures there's heaven and hell. One's really good and one's really bad.
Yeah, right.
And I don't think that life's so strong in that way. I mean, there are dualities, but I think they're much more complex than we might first associate.
Sure.
And I suppose now I'm on the other side of my 50s. I've gone up the hill and I'm now heading down the other side. Mm-hmm. I'm starting to think through those notions and those ideas.
Lisa Rehana is a Maori filmmaker whose film Tai Waituki, House of Death, will be shown in the Bishop Museum's Pacific Hall, and details are on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Earlier in the hour, we talked with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Junot Diaz about art's response to politics. Now a look at what the latest executive order on immigration is set to start on March 16, could mean for Hawaii. Civil Beat reporter Louis Kanea has today's reality check. Good morning. Aloha.
Good morning.
We have been talking now since the 27th of January about the old executive order, and now we have one set to go into effect next week. Is it really any better, or is it just sort of executive order light?
Well, depending on how you define better from which point of view, it's quite a bit different in terms of technical aspect of this. But, overall effect of what's going to happen probably won't be that much different. You know, if you recall, the old one basically suspended the refugee program for 120 days and, stopped people coming from seven majority Muslim countries, you know, the Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Syria, and Yemen. So it's essentially the new one does the same thing, except they don't single out the Syrian refugees for indefinite ban, and it drops the Iraq out of the seven countries, but you still keep the six majority Muslim countries. And
go ahead.
You know, I think what's going to be interesting is, you know, whether or not the new one is going to invite the whole bunch of lawsuits down the line, including ones from Hawaii. And
which we already saw what happened after the first one. Is there any indication from Hawaii's AG that, in fact, this is also going to spur some additional legal action?
Well, I'm about to go to this press conference, you know, I'm going to ask him that question. He has not said so far, since the new one came out, that he's going to do this definitively. But he has indicated in the past that, you know, this is something that he is very passionate about, and that he'd be watching out for this thing. And my bet would be that he is going to do something once the new order goes into effect next week.
It seemed that would be consistent with the way Attorney General Doug Chin looked at the first executive order. But is it possible for us to project out what this might mean for Hawaii if it stands?
I think, obviously, in order to do any kind of legal action, Doug Chin, he has to make a case that this actually harms Hawaii in unique ways. And, he has done that with the new one, with the old one. But the new one, it's going to be a little bit tricky because of all the technical differences. And, the main thing is that it exempts the permanent legal residents and people who hold visas already. So that takes out a whole bunch of people who might have, been able to sue in the past, have the standing, I guess, to sue the government. He can still make the case that there are certain people out there outside of the country who have the ties to the people here. And if he can make that particular argument, I think he may be able to bring the same case.
Well, you're going to hear more once you get to the press conference, and we'll talk about that, I'm sure, in a future reality check. Thanks so much for joining us this morning, Louis.
Thank you so much, Bethany.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Louis Kaneo.
Support for today's programming comes from Chamber Music Hawaii. The Honolulu Brass Quintet plays the music of Gershwin and more, March 13th at Palikou Theater and on the 20th at Doris Duke Theater. ChamberMusicHawaii.org.
Of all the qualities you'd want in your neighborhood, violence isn't one of them. Yet with tensions and anxiety high in communities around the country and even around our state, what should a community do to reduce violence with safety and justice? That question is the basis for a national issues forum this week at the state capitol. UH Urban and Regional Planning Professor Dolores Foley is one of the organizers. She's in our studio now. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
This idea that we have to be safe. What does safety really mean in a community? How safe can we be, and how much is a community responsible for its own safety? All of those ideas and questions seem to be the basis of what you're asking people to consider. Is that a question that they're really prepared to consider now?
I don't know if they're prepared, but I think it's a very subjective thing, and I think we do need to talk about what does safety mean to us as an individual and as a community, and what can we do to make so it's not somebody else's responsibility, it's all our responsibility.
In some ways, talking about something that is so personal and so necessary is also really difficult for people to do. And in trying to engage them in a conversation about this, I'm very curious what your response has been when you've had some community outreach and tried to talk about this in fits and spurts. Are we really believing that we are in some ways as unsafe as we really are? Or are people still perpetuating the myth that, well, Hawaii is different and we don't really need to worry about it so much?
I think there are. There is that aspect that we are different. We're not Ferguson. But I think, on the other hand, people are afraid. People do see violence, even on a small scale or even on a large scale. But I think the point is we have to talk about what it means to us and what we can do. How do we interact with police? How can we expand community and police relationships? How can we de-escalate violence? And what can we do? So the important part of the – it's always set up instead of having a panel of experts talking about what we are here and what it is on the mainland or what institutions are doing is really to explore. We start with a short video that's produced by the Kettering Foundation and National Issues Forum that sets out the issues. But then it's really about let's go through these options. And there's not just one option. We go through three options and ask people to really consider all the possibilities there are under each of the options and what are the trade-offs. What can be done by institutions, by us together, and so to really bring those forth. And I think these forums are happening all across the country. There's a 40 scheduled right now across the mainland with the idea of listening to people from all different cities and places and communities, and then they bring all this information together in May to legislators back in Washington. But the idea is that people have to talk about it within their own community. So there's a lot of room for saying, well, what do we think here in Hawaii?
And then to turn that around with information that will come back to Hawaii that would be Hawaii-specific. We know that we're already seeing incidents of road rage. Think about the one, this very recent one from, last weekend. It's not as if we know that or don't know that these things are happening here, but how does this information all filter back into the communities at a very deep and personal level where communities can make different choices and not just be sort of a funnel for a great deal of information that winds up in Washington?
I think we do have to think about what are those initiatives that we can do. I mean, I remember, 20, 25 years ago, we had the Live Aloha. Right. And so part of it was saying, well, we're not as nice on the road or whatever. But we've seen that get increasingly worse and more violent. So, again, there are things. OK, what could we do as a community? How can we work with the police? How can we work with our institutions? And how can we work within our neighborhoods to say, what can we see, stop? What can we intervene? There's all these different options, and a lot of them have, potential negative consequences. And if you intervene, are you a danger? So a lot of people don't want to intervene, but, what's the cost of not intervening?
There's also the social or cultural component to that about not getting into somebody else's business. You may not like it. There may be a fight in the street. There may be a couple arguing. We have a lot of issues surrounding domestic violence. But the idea of how much do you engage, how much responsibility do you take for the safety of your street, your neighborhood, your community, your city, just bringing it outward, that's tough for people when they already feel that there's so much coming at them, particularly now.
But I think if we do that, not just like that's my individual choice, but that's how do we need to think about this in a group, in a community, in a neighborhood. So you're not alone thinking about that. So you see an issue.
Earlier in the program when we talked to Gino Diaz and I asked him something similar, he said, well, that's when you get out and you start to work with other people. That's the only way that you're going to move through the feelings of being depressed or unable to do anything about something that seems so large and so unwieldy. But if you go on a one-to-one level and realize that there is something that you can do for someone else, that becomes the conduit back into not only your own humanity, but your own engagement.
And I think that's the benefit of forums like this, where people then hear other people's perspectives and say, well, I never thought of it that way, or how can we work together? And hopefully that initiatives come out of this, where people are willing to work together to solve some of these issues.
What would make you feel that this was a successful forum?
Well, one of the things is in past forums is I talk to people afterwards and they say, I didn't really change my mind so much as I heard a perspective and I listened and I really understood the other point of view. And then we went forward and we did X, Y, or Z as a result. So you see people reacting in different ways, but they come out of it feeling more empowered that, well, maybe there is something I can do.
Small victories is what I hear
small
you say.
Small victories.
All right. Well, here's to small victories then. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dolores Foley is a professor in the Department of Urban and Regional Planning at UH. Along with several other institutions, UH Manoa's College of Social Sciences is sponsoring a National Issues Forum Institute event on safety and justice. How should communities reduce violence? The public forum will be held on Thursday from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at the Hawaii State Capitol.
Aloha, I am Ron Branville from Easter Seals Hawaii. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
In today's backyard quiz, we had sunflowers on the brain. We asked you to give us the name of a small agricultural town somewhere in Hawaii that grows a large crop of sunflowers every year. Now, unlike the sunflowers that will be sprouting on Maui in the coming weeks, these sunflowers are not grown exclusively for producing biofuel. They're grown to test new varieties of sunflower and are eventually turned into sunflower seeds for human snacking and blooms sold as ornamental decorations. If the thought of a vibrant field of bright sunflowers framed by Emerald Mountains and the blue Pacific Ocean, well, then you are in luck. The fields are open to the public on a limited schedule, but you'll have to plan ahead. The sunflowers are only in bloom for a few weeks every year, usually around November and December. They can be found on the DuPont Pioneer Complex off Farrington Highway in Wailua on Oahu's North Shore. And that was the answer we were looking for. Nobody got that. But if you'd like details about booking a free tour so you can see those gorgeous sunflowers, you can just check out our Facebook page. That's today's Backyard Quiz. If you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
The state of Hawaii has set ambitious goals for itself in the realm of renewable energy, and it's unlikely they can be met without exploring any and every option out there, including some that are rarely explored. Sunflowers may seem an unlikely energy source, but they're part of an ambitious experiment being conducted by Pacific Biodiesel on a 115-acre site in Maui's Central Valley. Bob King is the company's president, and he's on the line with us this morning. Good morning, Bob. Thanks for talking with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You know, can you just sort of review with me the science behind biofuels in general? As I understand, just about any organic matter has potential as biofuel. Is that accurate?
Well, and the biofuel that we work with is biodiesel. And mm-hmm. biodiesel specifically is a fuel made out of vegetable oil or animal fat.
Okay.
So we can convert any triglyceride, any vegetable oil or animal fat into this fuel.
And what, burn it?
So basically the quick version of this is we take the glycerin out of the oil, mm-hmm. and that's the part that you can't burn, and then purify and distill the remaining material. And what you end up with is a fuel that looks just very, very similar to diesel fuel, and runs in any diesel engine just exactly like petroleum diesel fuel, except without a lot of the toxic emissions.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, does it burn cleaner?
It certainly does. And a lot of the emissions are half or a quarter what diesel is, and the really carcinogenic ones are, well, I don't know, 95% reduction. So
yeah.
Very, very clean. And the rest of it really is, you know, that what's happening in the engine more than the actual fuel.
So the real challenge then for you is to get, you know, the maximum amount of fuel in proportion to whatever crop you're using, right?
Right. So we currently collect all the waste oil, the used cooking oil and waste oils, trap grease and things on the islands. But that's, our customer base is larger than that. So we're, the next thing is to find another source of fuel from crops that mm-hmm. makes sense. And it's not doesn't have to necessarily be the highest yield per acre. What it needs to be is the lowest cost per gallon, because
yeah.
we're competing against a very established industry that has low price at the pump,
which has had what, a century or more to refine its yield and its cost. Yeah,
right. And there's a lot of the costs, of course, that we're realizing. The cost of burning fossil fuels are not all captured at the pump. There's health issues that into the billions of dollars a year that from these fuels, the environmental issues,
sure,
land issues. So all those things are not really captured at the pump. So you know, we really feel like this is a really solid economic fuel, and if you capture all those things, it's actually cheaper today than petroleum.
And do biofuels by their very nature burn cleaner than fossil fuels?
Yes, biodiesel does. Again, there's a lot of different kinds of biofuels.
Sure.
But on biodiesel, yeah, it's a very pure, clean molecule and doesn't have a lot of the fossil components that combust in a really odd manner that make these molecules that we don't want in the air, NPAHs and other components that are from these fossilized adaptations of actually vegetable oil. That's mm-hmm. that's what it all started as.
Yeah.
A few million years ago.
Well, why sunflowers?
Well, we've been farming for quite a while now, maybe 8 years, in little pieces here and there. We've tried a lot of different things. So we have things besides sunflower that we like, but sunflower is one of our favorites.
Mm-hmm.
It grows well in Hawaii, it looks real nice, and it's a good value crop, but it's not the only one, and it won't be the only one that we grow.
What are some of the others, Bob?
We're some of our top ones that my farmers like are safflower, which is mm-hmm. kind of a short, thistly-looking plant, but it loves the heat and dry. So
that's good.
When it's dry and hot out, that's our go-to crop. Camelina is another one. It's brassica. It's kind of a mustard type of plant.
Uh-huh.
A very nice crop, and of course we're really excited about trying industrial hemp if the regulations change and we can actually get that in the ground.
As industrial hemp as something you could burn for a biodiesel.
Yes. And all of these crops, we're going to do multiple things with them too. You know, we do want to make biodiesel out of them, but we'll take the best of the best of the oil and the plants and turn them into higher value products as well. In the case of sunflower oil, we'd love to just make cooking oil out of that, take it to the restaurant, and then get it back from the restaurant as used fryer oil to make biodiesel out of it. So we'll make food and fuel out of the same plant, and the safflower would be the same. Hemp, we don't know where that's going to go with selling seeds, selling oil, but for sure, anything that we can't sell anywhere else, we've got a hungry biodiesel plant that can suck up all the rest of the oil.
Well,
at a profit.
being able to sort of get use out of it on the front end and then the back end would has to have quite a bit of appeal, I would think.
It's a great way to do it.
Yeah.
And we certainly want to move in that direction.
I would also assume, Bob, that there was a comparable research being done at other locations around the world, research that you folks can share, yeah?
There is other research. It's interesting that we're fairly unique in trying to grow these particular kinds of crops in the tropics. Hmm. So, most of the time in the tropics, I think they've tended to grow things like palm, oil palms, or some of the other crops that have high labor content, because typically everybody's got cheap labor at the, I don't know why.
Yeah.
It just happens to be how the world set up. But that's not the case in Hawaii. So
no,
we're looking for things that we can grow with a reasonable labor investment. And that means, combine harvested, mechanized crops. That's where I want to focus anyway.
Well, Bob, it'll be interesting to sort of keep up with your research as this goes forward, because it sounds as if there's a great deal you're going to be learning. Thanks very much for talking with us.
All right, thank you.
Robert King is president of Pacific Biodiesel, which is creating a demonstration project this month of biofuel crops, including sunflowers, on a 115-acre site in Maui's Central Valley. And you can learn more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for today's programming comes from Maui Arts and Cultural Center, presenting Aparna Ramaswamy in They Rose at Dawn, a solo work depicting women as carriers of ritual, 7:30 p.m. this Thursday at Castle Theater, mauiarts.org.
There's always a lot of activities going on throughout the state, and our Morning Edition host and colleague Derek Malama joins us at this time in our show for a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. And Derek, one thing that's on a lot of people's minds is the fear of having their personal information hacked, and I almost get the feeling people are listening to our conversation right now.
Do you think? Well, let's hope so.
It's an eerie feeling.
Well, I have something that may help ease your mind and everyone else's. Yes. It's the 12th annual Consumer Protection Week Fair that brings over 24 government and nonprofit agencies together in one place. You can learn how to protect your identity, how to better manage your money, and ways to steer clear of scams. The fair is tomorrow from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Department of Commerce and Consumer Affairs. That's at 335 Merchant Street. That's the same building as the downtown post office, and it's free.
I think there's going to be a lot of interest in that.
Oh,
and
yes.
Tomorrow is International Women's Day.
Yes, yes, tomorrow. The UN Association of the USA Hawaii Island chapter screens the film Eleanor Roosevelt, First Lady of the World, and it tells the story of how Mrs. Roosevelt guided the creation of the Declaration of Human Rights. You can see it tomorrow at 5 p.m. for free in UH Hilo campus, UCB 100.
You know, she had a newspaper column that was in hundreds of papers around the country. Yeah, she was paid much attention to in her lifetime.
Yes, I'm sure we'll cover that in this film.
Yeah. And doctors recommend walking as the best way to get back in shape.
Yes, and walking with others can be even healthier. Mm-hmm. You can find a new way to get healthier, happier, and more connected by becoming a part of a walking Mo'ai team. And Mo'ai is Okinawan, and it means a meeting for a common purpose. Walking Mo'ai teams are groups of 5 to 8 people that meet at least once a week for 10 weeks to walk in the community. Register to join by attending a free launch event and walk tomorrow at Windward Mall from 5 to 6 p.m. Details are on our website at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Time to get to steppin'.
I agree. Let's do it.
Thanks a lot, Derek.
Okay, thank you.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that are under the radar, and you can always find out more about them on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Beth Ann, your conversation with Juno Diaz at the top of the show held out some hope in a fairly troubling situation.
Hope and also a real call to action to understand that you can't just sit there and feel bad about something, whatever it may be.
Whatever it is,
but the idea is to get up, take action, go do something, and hopefully something involving someone else who needs some help. Because you may not be able to affect things on the huge stage, but you may be able to start small in your own neighborhood mm-hmm. with something that's important to you, with someone else who just needs a little bit of help.
We've seen any number of examples in the last couple of months of how it has galvanized the arts community, for example.
That's true. And the idea about reaching out and being able to change how people are interacting with each other, even if it starts small, you have enough of that and you build momentum. That itself, as we've seen throughout history, that can become a movement.
Yeah, which it seems to be doing.
You bet. Now we're going to be moving out to go have some lunch, and perhaps you will be too. But we'll be back with you tomorrow. We'll be talking with Senator Josh Green. We'll take a look at the homelessness bills crossing over. Also, contributing editor Neil Milner will take the long view on a whole family approach to raising children and adults out of poverty.
And we'll meet the director of a new actors group production, Coyotes.
You can let us know about what you think about any of the guests or topics on the show. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, or on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation, or find me at BKOZHPR.
And past shows are under Talk Shows for the Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll see you in the morning. We'll see you tomorrow for more of The Conversation.